Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I hope everybody had a wonderful and long, relaxing Thanksgiving weekend. I know we did. Our Political Rewind team reported back this morning that it was good for all of them. Former Democratic Congressman from Cobb County, Buddy Darden, did you have a good weekend?
I had a wonderful weekend with my kids, grandkids, and also a birthday.
Oh, you? Yeah, we're not going to talk about how old you are we?
All right with me.
You're a little older than I am, but not much.
Not much.
I'm glad you could be here today, buddy. We always love having you with us. Brian Robinson, you not only did you apparently have a terrific Thanksgiving, but your Bulldogs now are getting set. I don't know how you can even be here paying attention to politics when your Bulldogs are just 5 days away from playing a rematch against Auburn for the SEC title.
I have to come here and think about politics to get a break from my excitement. I'm brimming with excitement.
Any of you who follow Brian on Facebook will be either delighted and thrilled or absolutely turned off by how completely his Facebook page is overrun with Bulldog.
By Twitter feed.
Oh, Twitter.
Yes,
okay.
It's my Twitter feed.
Well, I'm glad you're with us today. And also, congratulations. You know, we've called you an insider for quite some time because you are. You worked for Governor Nathan Deal. You worked for Congressman Lynn Westmoreland. You have a long history of working with Republicans in state and federal government. Now, you've also just been appointed as a member of the World Congress Center Board of Directors. Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you.
What's your? Did you want to give out your cell phone number for people who are looking for tickets to various events?
Yeah, you can find me at www.stubhub.com.
Connor Senn, Bloomberg Views, is also back with us today. We always like to have you here when we want to talk about budget issues, Connor, tax issues. Thanks for being here. How about your Thanksgiving?
Thanks. Well, my wife is a Bulldog, so we had a good Thanksgiving in my household as well.
Okay. Well, good. Hey, let me start with a couple of stories. We're going to talk about tax reform for a good part of the show today, first part of the show. But let's start with another item. Buddy Darden, this is one of those issues that I think is more fun to follow because of the jousting, then it, perhaps in the long run, what the impact is on ordinary Americans. Fair enough? We're talking about the Consumer Finance Safety Bureau, Protection Bureau. They now have two bosses. Mick Mulvaney, who's already budget director, showed up at 7:30 this morning because President Trump appointed him to fill a vacancy. Richard Cordray, who had been the director, decided to retire, but Cordray decided to quit a week early so he could put his number two in the acting director's job. Trump said, no, I want Mulvaney to run the place. And they both showed up 7:30, 8 o'clock this morning to become acting directors, but it was Mulvaney who brought donuts.
Well, what's unique about that organization is that it provides by statute, in order to stay independent of the president, that the interim director shall be named by the director. However, there's a conflicting statute which gives that authority to the president. So right now they have two heads, and it's going to be up to the court to decide. And I understand that the judge who's deciding is a Trump appointee.
Trump appointee.
So it's very, very confusing about what's going to happen here. But right now, while they went years and years and years with no head, they've got two heads now to run that organization.
The history of the organization is interesting. This was an agency that was created by the Obama administration coming out of the financial meltdown. The Obama White House decided it was important to put an organization online to monitor banks, financial institutions, to assure that they were not doing anything to defraud or to in any way undercut their customers, their consumers. Elizabeth Warren was initially going to be the head. Republicans rejected her because she was such a fierce critic of the banks and financial institutions.
And she got
and
the
so
last
she ran for Senate. Brian, this is not an organization we hear much about.
No, it's not. But it's one of these deep state things that people are talking about. You know, it is extremely powerful. And one of the issues that Republicans have with it is that it's largely unanswerable to anybody. It is an independent arm that if you get someone with a wild hair in there or is a little too authoritarian can really kind of circumvent the democratic process. So there is reason, there's something to be said for independence when protecting consumers. There's also something to be said for oversight. And this is one of those things we have to keep an eye on because they have a lot of power.
It's going to be decided by a judge. But, you know, it's interesting, Connor, is that the appointment of Mulvaney as acting director is fascinating because he's been a critic of this organization since before it was even created.
Yeah, I think when President Trump won, you couldn't expect that there to be a lot of strong oversight from the CFPB. So it wasn't going to be a very powerful organization in this administration anyway.
But, you know, this is how it's always going to be. For the most part, a lot of these oversight big government programs get started under Democratic administrations, and then through inertia, they stay funded and go through as part of the appropriations process. You know, as Ronald Reagan said, you know, we never cull government. Once there's nothing as immortal as a government program, and this is just another example of that.
All right. Well, we'll watch how that unfolds, how it goes in when it goes to federal court. In the meantime, all I can say is you bring donuts in the morning, and you got my loyalty for at least that one day, right? Let's talk about the Senate tax bill. Connor, the majority leader believes that it is possible for him to get this bill through the Senate this week. He's under a lot of pressure to move it as quickly as possible. The problem we have is understanding exactly what this bill does. I said in the promotions for today's show that to me, reading response to the Senate bill, as well as the House bill before it, which is already passed, is a partisan Rorschach test. You make the numbers work to argue for that the bill is a help to the middle class, is not a help to the middle class, does or doesn't help the wealthiest Americans. But today, last night, the Congressional Budget Office did release a report that suggested that the bill is going to hurt people, the poorest Americans, people earning $30,000 a year and less, more than it's going to hurt anybody else. And it gets progressive. By the year, I think, 2021, if you make $40,000 or less, you're going to be hurt by it. By 2027, $75,000 and less, you're going to be hurt. Whereas people who earn $100,000 or more are getting benefits out of this bill. Go.
I think if I'm a member of the middle class, the best thing about this bill is the fact that the cuts that I'm likely to get are set to expire. And the reason I say that is because it forces Congress to bring this up again a few years from now, potentially under a different administration. So this bill is very slanted towards corporations and the wealthy, and that's, you know, elections have consequences, so that's fine. But if you kind of want a more progressive bill that's actually more middle class focused, I think you need a different Congress to take a shot at this. So by having popular cuts phase out, it forces Congress to bring this up again in, say, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, buddy, the corporate tax is lowered to 20% permanently, but the individual tax cuts for people who are making more than, say, $75,000 to $100,000 phase out.
Absolutely. This was a dodge just to keep it so that the Senate would only have to have 51 votes to pass it. However, if you're making $200,000 or more, you're getting a big tax break. And let me respectfully submit that it's the folks who are making $200,000 or more that don't really need a tax break as much as those brackets below it. So I think it's a gift to the corporations. And quite frankly, I don't have any problem with lowering the rate if you cut out all the side deals that they are having, with the exception of Johnny Isaacson's special deal for Delta Airlines.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Let's talk about that in just a minute. But your overall take on you're a former communications director for a governor. You can make these numbers say anything you want them to. And the question then becomes, how do the American people understand what's going on?
You know, I think I would take a step back as a communicator. And my concern, if I was sitting at that table, isn't so much the details. Because I have two messages. One, we're cutting taxes like we promised we would. We're keeping a promise. And two, we're finally getting something done. We're finally showing that the president can get something across the finish line. And we're not there yet. It hasn't happened yet. But Republicans simply have to show they can govern. This really isn't just about taxes. It's about governance and showing that they can do something. I think the corporate tax cut is a good idea because it keeps us more in line with what other countries are doing globally. But I actually agree with Buddy. To do that, we need to make sure that we are getting rid of their other deductions and tax credits and that sort of thing. Because the fact is, the 35% corporate tax rate is not what corporations pay effectively.
That is the current rate that now will be dropped to 20%.
Which is much more competitive on a global scale. But let's get rid of the deductions that are built in there and just make it more of a flatter tax, which is what we all say we want.
Connor, the other big headline from the CBO's report is that they say this will add $1.4 trillion to the deficit. That hardly sounds like a Republican proposal coming. You know, they're not big on deficits, and this one's a whopper.
Well, the message from Senator Rand Paul and House Speaker Paul Ryan seems to be that really tax cuts are the goal, even if it expands the deficit, because the thinking is, or at least according to them, is that it will lead to more growth to offset the impact of the deficit. And the question is, how will that actually evolve in years to come?
Okay, and what is, okay, that's right, buddy, jump in on this.
Bill, I don't want to sound like a historian, but back in 1986 was the last, the major tax overhaul.
The Reagan tax overhaul.
And I happened to be in Congress at the time, and we had a whole year of hearings, and you remember that Ronald Reagan and Danny Rostenkowski, who was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee from Chicago, actually met. They went on television. Rosty went on TV, and remember the famous "Write Rosty and give him your opinion." And we spent a whole year on the tax reform bill, and when it finally passed the House of Representatives by agreement, there was a voice vote and not even a recorded vote. So what I'm suggesting is we can accomplish tax reform, but it shouldn't be solely a Republican issue.
Yes, but I also recall that Reagan bill. I wish I had it in front of me, because I also recall that one of the reasons you got it passed is if you looked at the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages in the markup of that bill, you had so many giveaways to so many different interests, and I'll bet that you were probably in the middle of some of that.
I was, and by the time this bill finally passes, it will be a Christmas tree. Because it will have so many special provisions, like the Isaacson position, which I have no problem with since Delta's based here in Georgia. However, you multiply that times 100 members of the Senate, and you've got a problem on your hands.
Well, that's how laws get passed. Yes, we don't always want to see how the sausage is made. But at the end of the day, sausage is delicious. And so I'm fine with it. This is part of the problem that Congress has had in recent years, in the last decade, is when they did away with earmarks, which is this great thing to trade on. You can get a vote for somebody because you're going to fund X project in Buddy's district, and then all of a sudden Buddy's going to vote for your bill. They don't have that tool anymore. And so in this bill, they actually have that tool. You can give gifts to senators or House members that help their districts, that help people back home. So this is a rare thing in the post-earmark era to be able to have that kind of horse trading, which may be why we actually get something passed.
Well, and I think, you know, as the Senate takes up the bill this week, while we haven't heard from a lot of senators who might be questionable on issues, and it could just be because they're kind of waiting to see where things shake out, if their votes are needed, what they can ask for. And so, you know, no one's really saying that they want to kill the bill, but there's a lot of people on the fence kind of waiting to see what they can get out of it.
One of the points I want to make here is I read off the income levels that are going to be hurt most, according to the Congressional Budget Office. But what's interesting about that, Buddy, is the fact is the people who earn $30,000 or less currently mostly don't pay taxes anyway. In that tax, they're not in a bracket where they end up paying taxes. The reason CBO has cited them is because what is going to happen is if the Senate passes the amendment or the provision rather that would eliminate the individual mandate on insurance, it will reduce the ability of people in that income bracket to get government help for their health care. And that's one of the reasons they're going to end up losing money in this.
And regrettably, those people don't have a lobbyist in Washington. They don't have anybody that they can pay to go to Washington and give their side of it. And unfortunately, I think those are the people who are going to get the short end of the stick.
What do we make, Brian, of the notion that Connor brought up, that Republicans have traditionally talked about? When you lower corporate taxes, when you lower taxes on business, you grow the economy, you make businesses more productive, you put more people into jobs, you can pay them better wages. Is there anything historical data which suggests that that really happens?
I don't, you know, obviously we've had economic growth after major tax cuts. There was economic growth throughout the 1980s after the Reagan tax cuts. There was tremendous growth in the 1960s after the Kennedy tax cuts. Now, whether there's a complete 100% correlation, I'm not an economist. I can't make that decision. But there is some correlation there. And I would take it a step back, though, and say this isn't just about what the outcomes are going to be. Republicans believe that people who work hard and get ahead and make the right decisions should be able to keep more of their money. And the reason why the wealthy will have a bigger windfall in this is because they make more money and they pay more in taxes. We are at a point, given the earned income tax credit and other programs for low income and lower middle income people, where a significant portion of the American population does not pay federal income tax. So, of course, they're not going to get a tax cut. It is the people who are paying the current taxes who are going to get the cut.
So, go ahead.
In the 1980s, with President Reagan, the dominant economic ideology among Republicans was supply-side economics. And the thinking at the time was that if you can get government out of the way or reduce bottlenecks in the economy, you can lead to more growth. And so at that point, you had very high interest rates and high inflation. And so the thinking was you really had to help out capital and investors and corporations because that was really what was holding back the economy. The issue today is that we have very low inflation, very low interest rates, and we have very low labor force participation. So I would argue the kind of supply side reforms we need now is to increase the labor force and labor supply. And we haven't seen that in this bill.
Go ahead, buddy.
I want to point out also that very famous video clip we saw just a couple of weeks ago when the President's Chairman of Economic Advisors asked all these assembled CEOs if it would make any difference to them and so far as the number of people they employed and wages and so forth if they got a tax cut, and very, very few hands went up.
Yeah, Gary Cohn, he essentially said it when he saw the response, gee, I thought there'd be more hands going up in this room.
Let me say, I think one thing like the corporate tax rate cut, one thing that will do that will help the economy is we have a lot of American-based corporations with money offshore, and lowering this rate may incentivize them, and this is certainly something that David Perdue, our senator, talks about a lot, may incentivize those companies to onshore that money, to bring it back and put it back into the American economy. That could be one positive economic indicator. But let me say, I am a balanced budget Republican. That is my ethos. And one thing that bothers me is that we sometimes, in order to get stuff passed, we engage in this public conversation that isn't accurate. The idea that tax cuts pay for themselves is not true. And I'm tired of magic. I don't like dealing with magic when Democrats are doing it. I don't like it when my side does it either. I want to see these cuts paired with serious spending reforms, particularly entitlement reform, because it is going to bankrupt this country. I agree with my Republican brethren that we cannot tax our way into a balanced budget. It would hurt the economy too much to go up that much. But we've got to reform entitlements or we are headed for the rocks.
All right. So we're going to have to get a break in. And when we come back, we will talk about the break that Donny Isaacson's hoping Delta Airlines will get out of this measure. But before we go to the break, I don't think anybody would argue with what Brian says about trying to get our spending in line with the revenues we're bringing in. But there are such strange ways that the Republicans in both the House and Senate are dealing with this issue. We talked on the show last week about the way in which college students are going to be penalized by this measure. They're going to lose the ability to deduct the interest on college loans. We talked about the fact that students whose parents work in private institutions they'll not have to pay tax on the free tuition that they're getting. So you've got to wonder why we're in a position where we're trying to discourage higher ed. But then there's this other thing going on where school teachers who go to the store and out of their own pockets pay for material supplies for their kids are going to lose their tax deductions in the Senate version of this bill. That just seems to be so tone deaf, Connor.
Well, it seems like the corporate cuts are based on economic theory anyway, about how cutting corporate taxes will lead to investment in jobs and so on. The revenue offsets seem much more based on politics and coalitions. So if higher ed and teachers and rich people in New York tend to be Democrats, then those are the ones getting hit. That's not really based on economics or job growth, but just, well, that's not our side.
Let's face it, the only way you can ever achieve fiscal stability in the United States is by a combination of revenues, cuts, and entitlement reform. And you remember the Clinton tax plan, which got so much criticism when it was first passed, but it led to the first balanced budget in years since World War II, and also a surplus one year. So you've got to have a combination of revenues, entitlement reform, and some tax cuts would be good.
All right, let's do this. Let's get a break in, and when we come back, we'll mention that Delta Airlines break that Johnny Isaacson is trying to insert in the bill. And we'll move on and talk a bit about some very recent developments in the Atlanta mayor's race and some really interesting state news as well. But we'll take a break first. This is Political Rewind.
Hey, this is David Greene, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut, Connor Senn, Brian Robinson, and Buddy Darden join me at our post-Thanksgiving table in the studio today. Buddy, you've mentioned it a couple times. What is Johnny Isaacson trying to do with this tax bill that'll help our hometown airline, Delta?
Well as you know, Delta's had a real problem with various airlines from the Middle East, like the United Arab Emirates and other places like that, because he doesn't think that they have the same tax liability the United States companies do. So what he's trying to do, I believe, is level the playing field. This has shown itself in several different legislative initiatives. You remember for a while, they tried to block the renewal of the Export-Import Bank for a while, and all kinds of things to try to keep from giving tax breaks or unfair advantage to those airlines who are from the Middle East and who do business here. In fact, Delta got so mad they withdrew their support from the Fox Theater because the airlines from the Middle East were contributing to the Fox Theater. So it's been a very highly emotional issue, highly emotional issue for Delta. And Delta's kind of prevailed on our senior senator to take a direct frontal assault rather than some indirect method, and I think it's probably going to work because everybody thinks that they ought to pay more taxes, especially if you can tax somebody from a foreign country or foreign company. So I say let him have at it.
Well, as long as what this doesn't lead to, I mean, I get it. We know that Delta is extraordinarily important to the city of Atlanta. We have no question. At the same time, if the issue that Delta is worried about is that the Middle Eastern airlines like Qatar and others, Air Emirates, come in and are able to lower the ticket price, the question becomes, is Johnny Isaacson's bill good news for people who are flying internationally?
Well, airlines have always been one of those industries that we have had protectionism for, and Americans seem to, at least, you know, in terms of how we legislate, seem to support that.
All right. Well, we'll watch how that goes. Go ahead, Brian.
This issue plays itself out in many ways. We deal constantly with competition with Chinese companies that are funded by the Chinese state. Another Atlanta company, UPS, teams up with FedEx to fight DHL, which is a German-based package delivery company that is subsidized by German taxpayers. So this is not a standalone issue. This is something that's very common. And what Johnny Isaacson is doing is what senators are supposed to do. They are fighting for a hometown interest. Now, it is the Middle East airlines' right to say this is about consumer choice and best prices. But the fact of the matter is, as long as we have non-subsidized industries, we're going to have these battles in our country.
But in all fairness, Delta is subsidized also, as you well know, in more indirect ways as far as the tax code and other ways. So we're all in this thing together, and we've always subsidized American companies in indirect ways, if not direct ways.
All right. So as we get off this topic, and we started by saying that the Senate is being urged by the majority leader to work on this bill to get a vote out by the end of the week. Connor, you pointed out we just got one no. Steve Daines, senator from Montana, says he's voting against it. On the other hand, Rand Paul, who I'm a little surprised that he jumped on board so quickly because he's been a big deficit hawk for a long time, but he says he supports it.
Rand Paul's view is that the bigger the tax cuts, the better, and that tax cuts are a priority over the deficit.
Okay.
That's his words.
We're still waiting. This thing is not a sure deal. I mean, we don't know what Susan Collins is thinking. We have no idea what Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, who are President Trump's least favorite members, at least this week,
I have
the
idea
United
what
States
they're thinking.
Senate.
Yeah.
And we haven't heard from John McCain. So this is a very shaky deal for Republicans.
We've also heard concerns from Ron Johnson in Wisconsin pass-throughs. So we're waiting to hear
that. All right. I've got to ask this. Help me understand. I have no idea. And I'll bet you there are listeners out there who don't get pass-throughs have a bigger impact on smaller businesses.
Like me, I'm a pass-through.
What
business.
Is a pass-through? Help us all understand this.
Well, for those of you out there in the market for a public affairs communications firm, I happen to own one called Robinson Republic LLC. But Robinson Republic LLC is me. And I pay the taxes for Robinson Republic LLC on Brian Robinson's personal income tax. And so that's the pass-through. So whatever money is there is my money, but it's this separate entity.
And the concern that Johnson has, because he's got a background in this as well, is that if you're doing this big corporate cut for corporations and you're not doing it for pass-throughs, then you're disadvantaging pass-throughs.
Okay, we've
and I'm against disadvantaging pass-throughs. Okay. I'm pro pass-throughs.
Gotcha. We've gotten a lot of response on Twitter. Sam Burnham says Brian Robinson is right. Tax cuts don't cause deficits. Spending causes deficits. Cut spending. Richard Boder. Says trickle-down economics is fake. It's never worked. It increases the deficit with some theory about business increasing. He also said that the rich pay more taxes is a flat-out lie. They pay a lower percentage, they actually have a higher rate, but they pay a lower percentage. And then he said we are not the highest tax nation. Please correct this often repeated lie. I'm pretty sure no one in the studio today claimed that we do have a higher corporate tax rate than I think many other countries.
Yes, a higher corporate tax rate, but at the same time, as Brian pointed out a while ago, it's a much lower effective rate because by the time they get through all the deductions and sweetheart deals that have been given by the Congress for years,
okay,
both Democrat and Republican, it's less than 35.
Okay, so then when President Trump uses that as a cudgel, as a weapon, to say we've got to lower the rate, in fact, he's the one who's not being accurate in terms of the rate that corporations are actually paying.
What are you saying? It's true. It is. That is the rate. It is 35%.
But they're not paying it.
They're not paying that.
All right.
But that is the rate.
All right. Let's move on. We're just hours away now. In fact, 24 hours from now, we'll be in the middle of the Georgia Public Broadcasting mayoral runoff debate between Keisha Bottoms and Mary Norwood. Which you'll be able to listen to. If you're in Atlanta, you'll hear it live on 88.5 FM. We thought that perhaps the rest of you across the state might not be quite as interested, but if you are, we're also streaming it by video at gpb.org and on the GPB Facebook page. It promises to be a pretty interesting debate, I think. We have some breaking news today, buddy. Lots of endorsements coming in the last few days for both Bottoms and Norwood. Today, Norwood picked up an interesting endorsement. Shirley Franklin endorsed Mary Norwood. And it's probably a big boost to her campaign to have the previous mayor of the city before Kasim Reed, an African-American woman, endorsing her, I would think.
Well, that's especially interesting in light of the fact that her mentor, Andrew Young, former mayor and former United States ambassador and general well-known Atlantan, that endorsed Keisha Bottoms. So I have no real feeling here about who's ahead and who's going to win this thing. I live in the city of Marietta, and I voted for Thunder Tumlin for mayor. But
how could you not vote for
a guy with that name? Oh, my watching the city of Atlanta politics for years and years, I have never been as uncertain about the outcome as I am this time, because even in our own law firm, we have about half on one side, half on another, and that's not by design either.
Right.
People just have genuine disagreements and differences of opinion here, and it's hard to sort it out, especially with the fact that Shirley Franklin is for Norwood and Andy Young is for Bottom.
Yeah, we should also point out that Peter Amon, who was a candidate for mayor and was a big Buckhead candidate, also endorsed Norwood today. But, Brian, Shirley Franklin was here a week ago Friday, and she wouldn't quite address what I think was the major question many people, certainly Jim Galloway and I, and by the way, Galloway's taking the day off today. That's why he's not here. He'll be here for the debate tomorrow.
I'm sitting at his seat of authority today.
That's right. there's a little payback here in Shirley Franklin's endorsement. She has felt that when Kasim Reed followed her in office, he never gave her the credit she deserved for the things she accomplished. And it became a real sore point between the two of them, despite the fact that Kasim Reed had been her campaign manager when she was running for mayor. So there's got to be a little personal payback here.
Well, this is not the only example of that. You know, Caesar Mitchell obviously went out and endorsed Mary Norwood because Kasim Reed has put a target on Caesar's back and has shot him every chance he got. And so it's part of where Keisha Lance Bottoms has the benefit of the mayor's machine, but is also getting his enemies inherited as well. And his enemy and his enemies and Bottoms are now Bottoms' enemies, and they're lining up with Mary Norwood. But can I just say that one thing I find fascinating and heartening is, isn't it awesome that we're at a place where you've got all of these African-Americans lining up behind Mary Norwood, and you've got all of these white Democrats lining up behind Keisha Lance Bottoms, that we're deciding this election not on the color of the skin of the candidates running, although I'm sure some people will vote on that basis, but this has to do with different alliances that have nothing to do with race. Isn't that fantastic that we are at that place? And isn't it something that Amazon should take a look at when they're considering a place to come and locate their second headquarters?
I think if you look at the candidates who made it to the runoff is still sort of those old coalitions of northern white Atlantans versus southern black Atlantans. But the sort of we're seeing in the runoff is really that middle, that midtown, east side sort of multicultural coalition might be the swing vote in this. And this could be a sign of the future of Atlanta politics.
And that LGBT vote in that same area could be huge. And one thing, LGBT voters in midtown and in east Atlanta, and very much with older African-American female voters on the south side of town, these are super voters. These are people who are going to show up for a special election runoff. And they will have an outsized voice in this election.
And need I warn both candidates that they need to be especially careful about what they say, because the slightest shade of racism or the slightest shade of slight to anybody, you know, becomes a major news story. For example, I was talking with the man who monitored the election on the state-appointed monitor back when Mayor Reed was elected in the runoff. Back in 2009.
Against Mary Norwood.
And he told me that there were no irregularities at all, and it was a well-run election. However, she made the statement to certain groups, I think it was the Young Republicans in Buckhead, that there had been fraud in the last time, and that was a mistake. Now, same thing has happened, I'm sure, on the side of the Bottoms campaign. So I would encourage both of them to be extremely measured in their rhetoric, as they will be, I'm sure, in the next week.
Andy Young made a call to our colleague Jim Galloway on Thanksgiving morning, thereby disrupting Galloway's hope to have a long weekend of rest. But it was a very interesting phone call.
Galloway loved it.
Yeah, of course he did. Of course he did. And who can blame him? And Andy Young made much the same point. But he pointed out something fascinating, I thought, Connor. Keisha Lance Bottoms has been criticized, or there's been a cloud of doubt cast above her because she and her husband have an expensive vacation home at Martha's Vineyard, and there are those who have tried to use that. In fact, I was literally walking into a shop on Highland right near Ponce de Leon the other day and found on the ground a flyer that raised questions about how was she able to pay for that house. And Andy Young, I thought, made a very important point. I think he may have been a little angry. We'd have to ask Galloway about this, that accusations that this is somehow a result of corruption absolutely overlook the fact that her husband, Bottom's husband, is a successful attorney with Home Depot, has been there for a long, long time. She's been a successful attorney. And there's a little bit of racial, I think he's questioning to some extent whether race plays a role in that.
That's a good point. And also you notice, I'm sure you're aware, that Mary Norwood's husband is a highly regarded and very successful physician, and nobody said anything about that because that's expected.
So Norwood, the other side of that is that Norwood, Andy, also suggests that when you call Mary Norwood a Republican, in the same way you're kind of very subtly raising a racial issue because,
yes,
of course, Republicans are all white guys like you, right, Brian?
That's right. That's the requirements for the club. Yeah. That it is. Going what Buddy said earlier about look for the subtle hints on racist or racial signaling, and talking about Mary Norwood being Republican is racial signaling in this race. Probably wouldn't be in most races in this country, but in this one, that's what it means.
Now,
that's
wait a minute. I'm a Democrat. I'm a proud Democrat. And Brian, you used to work for Democrats.
Yeah, only you, buddy.
All right.
I mean, I think I'm 36, and in my friend group anyway, I think we're trying to get past this to some extent and really sort of embrace all Atlanta. I think City Councilman Andre Dickens has done a great job in being a leader on this issue, and I hope that we can continue to make progress on this in the future.
All right, well, we're going to watch it. Again, the GPB radio debate is live at 2 o'clock tomorrow, a special edition of Political Rewind. Excuse me, I'll be here. Monica Pearson, my old colleague from WSB-TV, will join me on the panel. And, of course, Jim Galloway. We couldn't do a debate without Jim Galloway as part of it. So, again, tune in at 88.5 in Atlanta and watch us at gpb.org or on the GPB Facebook page tomorrow at 2. Let's get another break in. And then we got some really interesting stories. Did you know that journalists are starting to wear the color purple as a secret symbol of their complicity in trying to push forward their liberal agenda?
Well, Buddy got the memo.
And we'll talk about that after this.
On the next Fresh Air, comic and actor Patton Oswalt. He has a new Netflix comedy special called Annihilation. It's in part about living in the Trump era. It's also about the unexpected death of his wife last year and having to find a way to prevent himself and his young daughter from falling to pieces. Join us.
Tune in for Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. So, Jim Galloway, again, he's off, but he seems to be posting more than when he's on, or maybe just as much. He had a really interesting item today, and let me see if I can pull it out here from my pile of papers. The chair of the Forsyth County...
Fayette County.
I'm sorry, Fayette County Republican Party. Thank you, Brian.
Who is African American, by the way?
Yeah, he is an African American. He has said that journalists, have we noticed how journalists always seem to wear purple neckties like the one you have on today, even though you're not a journalist, buddy. They are signaling their liberal conspiracy, and this is how they come together to promote liberal causes. Brian, I think it sounds like a pretty good theory to me.
He's dead on right. I'm glad this has finally been exposed and that we have brought this into the light. I think American news consumers need to be informed, and so that they know they're being fed hogwash that is all part of this liberal agenda. And I'm glad that somebody is finally standing up and saying it.
All right, but he means this. He apparently.
Oh no!
This is
surely
not a
he
joke.
Can't mean that.
No.
This is not a joke.
Let me. All right.
I was joking, just for the record.
All right. It took me a minute. All right. This comes from Fayette County Republican Party Chair, GOP Chair Tyrone Jones. Observe closely as you watch the pundits in the media. They have a silent signal they send to one another. They wear purple. The men wear purple neckties. The women have increased their purchases of purple garments. It's called subliminal messaging. The media in America has succumbed to this progressive ideology and is poisoning our society by making listeners believe they are truth tellers. And purple is the secret color of the conspiracy. Now, Brian, what do you make of this? I mean, I understand mistrust and suspicion of the media, and this is not the biggest story that we're going to cover this week, but it's another sign of just the gap between where we are in the media and where some people out there in the conservative movement exist today.
Well, I think that there is a lot of conspiracy theories out there these days, and obviously, this is. I'm with Buddy. I would like to think it was a joke, but I don't think that it was a joke. I think this person honestly believes that's the case. I don't think we need to come up with conspiracy theories on whether or not journalists are liberals. We know they are because we read their stuff and we see them on TV.
Oh,
why isn't that enough?
All right. I don't even want to get into an argument about
that. In light of all
that.
The sex scandals going on these days, does that purple include underwear as well?
All right.
Let's ask John Conyers.
You know what? All right. I think we've done about as much with this subject as we need to. Sally Yates is in the news again, and I think in an interesting context, and one that probably deserves some conversation. And is bigger than the area right now that they're talking about. The city of Calhoun is under some fire by people like Sally Yates, who have stepped forward to say that the bail policies in the city are harmful to indigent defendants, that people who cannot pay bail are thrown in jail in what is essentially, I think it's fair to say, a version of debtor's prison, Buddy.
Had a nice conversation with Sally about a week ago when she received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Constitutional Society, and she did mention the case, but we talked pleasantries. However, I've followed that case pretty carefully, and she has gone out of her way not to be involved in any political type of activity. In my opinion, this was maybe an initiative from Georgetown University, which is where she's employed now, and she happened to sign on to it, being a former prosecutor and being someone who's concerned not only with the prosecution but also the rights of the individual. So I wouldn't read that much into it. Maybe you've got a different take on it.
I mean, I know that Senator Kamala Harris in California has raised this as an issue as part of her criminal justice reform plank. So even if it wasn't intentional on Yates' part, you could say it's part of a larger movement on the part of progressives right now.
Well, I don't think it wasn't intentional. I mean, I would assume that Sally Yates is a woman of integrity and therefore only signs on to issues that she believes in to some extent. But without regard to whether Sally Yates is, she's not the central figure around all of this. But it does raise an interesting issue, Brian Robinson, about whether bail laws need to be studied to see whether they put the poorest defendants at risk of being thrown into jail when people with more money are able to get out easily. That's a very important issue, it strikes me.
Well, I appreciate what Connor had to say. I will not give this issue to the progressives, though. This is something that conservative governors, including our own Nathan Deal, has led on and made significant changes on. This is criminal justice reform. whatever issue is in Calhoun, I think we can probably fix it on the local level with state legislation. I do think there's obviously disparity. And the thing that we need to think about is it doesn't just hurt the individual who's going to lose their job because they can't get to work or who can't pick up their kids from school because they're in jail. It's also hurting taxpayers because we are keeping nonviolent, non-threats to society in jail at a cost to local taxpayers. And that's not make-believe money like the federal money with their massive deficits. These are real dollars that come out of our property taxes. And so we need to watch those dollars carefully. And criminal justice reform isn't just soft on – I'm sorry. I'm going to take that back. Criminal justice reform is not soft on crime. It is smart on crime.
Let me, for once, totally and absolutely agree with everything that Brian has said and said. I'm a former district attorney in another life, and I see the guy who was a test case from up in Calhoun was charged with being a pedestrian drunk.
Yeah.
Now, and he spent 6 days in there, and if he had come in and pled guilty that day in Cobb, we probably would have released him on time served. And so I just think it's unconscionable what happened in his particular case, and these bad cases are the ones, which means the law needs to be reformed.
And let me say one thing that we need to look at in Georgia, and maybe this is another step for the justice reforms initiatives that are we're seeing changes incrementally every year, but there is severe disparity from jurisdiction to jurisdiction in this state, as Buddy alluded to there. If you get caught with marijuana in Atlanta, you might not even get arrested anymore if it's a small amount. But in some small counties in Georgia, some more rural areas, you may end up spending a significant amount of time in a county jail for having a small amount of marijuana. To me, that gets to an equal justice, or whatever you lawyers would call it, people being treated the same under the law issue.
Equal protection of the
law. Equal protection, yeah.
All right. Let me move on to another issue here. Speaking of, we talked about journalists a minute ago wearing purple. To the best of my knowledge, Nydia Tisdale has not, I haven't seen her wearing purple very often. She is a citizen journalist. She has a great reputation for showing up at public meetings all over North Georgia with a video camera. She believes in the right of all people to be able to watch the proceedings of their elected officials. And she is, her trial began today. Was your boss up there? Was Nathan Deal part of that that incident which led to her? As I recall, he was.
Oh, yeah.
So this happened at Bert's Pumpkin Farm in Dawsonville.
Yep.
And who hasn't bought a pumpkin from Bert at Halloween
time? It's a famous place, yeah.
It's an amazing place to go. But it was a big Republican state gathering with elected officials like the governor. Nydia Tisdale brought her video camera, wanted to video all of the speakers.
Yeah.
She was told by
Ralph Hudgens.
Ralph Hudgens, insurance commissioner, to stop. Because apparently, Brian, was this during your tenure or was this
Oh,
after?
Yes. I had to deal with this.
All right. That's
what
I thought.
It was a major headache, and I just could not understand why I was having to deal with this.
All right. The way this story goes is that you had been tipped that the Democrats were going to send their folks to get video that they could use against you, right?
Yeah, which we trackers.
Trackers.
Is what they're called. And we both use them. I don't know if they knew who Nydia was or not. Obviously, she did have some local renown because she had caused some stirs in, I believe, in Cumming, with City of Cumming, with taping some city council meetings there. So, but I don't know that these statewide officials knew who she was. They just saw someone with a video camera. Now, that said, it was stupid, and then Attorney General Sam Wolin said this at the time, it was stupid to do anything to her because this was, there was nothing being said that should not be able to be put on YouTube without any concern. If you're speaking to a political rally, you should accept that it's going to be a public record. So it was a completely dumb thing. She should not have been arrested. She should not have been physically accosted anyway. And this case should not be going on for three years.
She's in Dawson County Superior Court today, Buddy, facing a felony charge of willfully obstructing a law enforcement officer and a misdemeanor criminal trespass charge. She apparently, when the deputies came to pull her away from the podium, she apparently pushed back a little bit. Hence these charges. She could go to jail for a couple of years.
As district attorney, I would have buried that case so fast, you would have never heard from it.
Which is maybe why 3 years later we're still talking about this. Absolutely insane indictment of our justice system that this would last for 3 years. I think for sure that felony charge will get dropped. She's never going to see any jail time. I think if anything, it'll be, Ms. Tisdale, I'm sorry for the headache. Have a good day.
All right. Well, we're going to watch how that unfolds. It strikes me that, as Buddy points out, that could have happened at any point during this three-year journey to get to trial in a courtroom in Dawson County. So we'll see how that unfolds. One last item. I want to take a quick go-round on this. I want to know your odds on this bill's passing, okay? An Armurchi Republican, Eddie Lumsden, has just introduced a bill, dropped it in the hopper for the Georgia legislature, that would ban cell phone talks while you're driving your car. Wow. Connor, what are the odds?
With even hands-free and just all ban everything.
I don't know the details yet. We haven't read the whole bill.
He would allow hands-free.
Oh, okay. Well, then what's that?
50%.
All right.
10%.
25%.
All right. Okay. So we all kind of chuckle at that because this is almost like taking away the Hope Scholarship. You don't take cell phones out of the hands of people who are used to talking while they drive. And yet, Buddy, he does raise a perfectly reasonable and sensible public safety issue.
Absolutely. You're in more danger with someone texting coming towards you or than you are with a drunk driver these days, statistically.
Well, texting is already illegal.
Yeah. Yes, but
in Georgia, but it's not enforced.
But they're still doing it, and you can't prove that texting.
It's a secondary offense, as I recall. You can't be pulled over for texting while driving. Doesn't there have to be another offense involved, or have I got that wrong? Well,
I think that's a seatbelt law.
Well, that too. But the point is, it is certainly not being enforced. So.
Right. Because it's impractical to do so. I mean, if you run over somebody or hit another car because you were texting and you were distracted, it's impossible, barring video evidence from a streetlight, that you were doing that. There's no way to prove it.
I watch an awful lot of police procedural TV shows.
And there's always video.
No, they're always using texting, unlocking the phone and getting the text to prove their case. All right.
Right.
We're completely out of time for today's show. Connor Senn, Buddy Darden, Brian Robinson, thank you for being here today. And thank you, Tom Barclay stepped in, our operations director. We've got a boss running our board today, and we appreciate that. Tom, Olivia Rheingold, Tom Faust, thank you. Remember, we'll see you again tomorrow at 2 o'clock for a live special edition of Political Rewind, the Atlanta mayoral debate between Mary Norwood and Keisha Lance Bottoms. Jim Galloway, Monica Pearson, and I will be here to talk to them about what they want to do, their dreams for the city of Atlanta. Thanks for joining us today. See you again for the debate tomorrow.